As far as preaching goes, I'm the kind of preacher that a lot of, you've obviously I've been in this role for a little while now, a lot of what happens in my life comes out while I preach. In my family, in my neighborhood, in our community, in our world, it seems like, for me, it's like there's a television show on the Food Network that I used to watch way late at night whenever I was trying to write seminary papers called Chopped, and they'd go in and they'd like have all these crazy ingredients, and then they'd try to figure out how to make something out of things that should never go together. And sometimes preaching feels like that, and so I start to like comb through my life looking for the tidbits of the places where God's presence has been real, or where there's particularly, I remember one of my friends said, the things that get me really angry or the things that get me really excited and hopeful. And it feels like in my life, as I looked over the last 2 weeks, I mean, as I combed through my life, the number of things that seemed hopeless, just, I could barely move the comb through my life at all. And it's Ukraine for the last 3 months. It's wars that nobody's heard of. A dozen wars across the world that have been going on for years and years and years. And it's Buffalo, and it's Western Texas, and it's injustice, and it's hunger. That has nothing to do with congregational conversations and broader churnings in our world. There's just so much going on. And I don't think we can ignore that. So I say those things, recognizing that some of you are coming into this morning with considerable weight. Weight as violence reigns, it seems like, and as all around us is just hopelessness. Sometimes it feels like we were driving to church this morning, and Isaiah asked me, he said, why didn't we cut down the trees at the bottom? Why did we start at the top? And I said, some context. We had 3 diseased ash trees in our yard. And as soon as you hear those ash trees, everyone's heart just goes, because these must have been 50, 60, 70, I don't know how old they were, trees in our backyard. We live in downtown Harrisonburg. And we realized that they were ash trees, maybe the year after we moved in. And we realized how bad it was going to be because of the emerald ash borer, right? This insect that, I think insect, right? That burrows it. I didn't pay attention very well in science. But it burrows in and it kills the tree. And so the ash tree in the United States is, I mean, it's going extinct. And it's really hopeless, to be honest. We cut into one of the trees. It must have been this thick. It was the tree that held up our kids' playhouse. It must have been this thick. And whenever they cut through it with the chainsaw, it was like a knife through butter, because there was only this much live ring left, and this much of it had rotted out on the inside. And I said to my wife, Teresa, I said, you were right. It was time to take down the trees. Because I hated to see that loss. I think if I'm being honest, I hated to admit that that was like the reality. Do you know what I mean? Like, I hated to admit that that was the thing that needed to be done. It's like when you start to sense that there's something wrong with a tooth, or when you sense that there's something in the engine of the car that's not running quite right. For the teeth, man, my goodness, my stomach just sinks. And I say, oh, that can't be what's going on, because I never want it to be something big that needs to be fixed. Or in our cars, you know, you feel this little pull or this little rumble, and you say, oh, no. I remember we were driving up the side of the mountain coming back from the Charlottesville airport. I might have told this story once before, but I was picking up my brother at the airport in this Buick, 1992 Buick LeSabre that had been gifted to us from a family member. And all of a sudden, I heard this little, and I was like, oh. So I pulled off. I checked my fluids. I know how to do like 3 things on a car. So I checked the fluids. I pretended like I knew what I was doing. It was my brother, so I didn't have to pretend very hard. Neither of us know anything about cars. And I was like, well, it's not one of the three things that I know how to check. The tires aren't flat. We still have oil and coolant, and I don't see anything on fire. So we start driving a little bit further, and we hit the bottom of the base, coming over 33, over the base of the and it was a, and I was like, oh no, and so we go a little bit further, and pretty soon I can't get out of third gear, and then I can't get out of second gear as I go up the mountain, and I think to myself, if we can just get to the top of the mountain, maybe we can coast down to Elkton and then get a tow from Elkton in. And right before we crested the mountain, smoke begins to billow out from underneath the hood of my beloved 1992 Buick LeSabre. And I mean, there's not a physical fire that I can see, but the car is gone. It's hopeless. I think that kind of hopeless feeling is a lot of what I've felt in the last week in particular. I'm a public elementary school teacher. So I do half time. I'm very grateful for that job in Elkton. I love my job. I love my students. And I love my coworkers. So when I looked at this text, there was like eight different directions that I felt like there could have been a sermon in each corner of it that I wanted to preach. And I thought, you know, I could preach a whole sermon on the proclamation that the little girl makes. I could preach a whole sermon on human trafficking and on the hopelessness of that and how we need to step in and step forward and stand in along with as accomplices as we dismantle those systems. I could preach a whole sermon on the freedom that the little girl experiences from spiritual and physical bondage that held her in captivity. I could preach a whole sermon on how angry I am that Paul didn't drive out that spiritual force of evil the first time that he realized what was going on, instead of getting so annoyed from her unsolicited publicity. I could preach a whole sermon on how they sang and prayed even as they were locked up in jail. I could preach a whole sermon on the freedom, the power that they experience, freedom from fear, freedom in the Spirit of God as they should have been hopeless, as they lived in hope. I kept getting stuck on that word freedom. And I know that tomorrow's Memorial Day, and freedom means a lot of people, a lot of things for a lot of different people. But the freedom that I read in this passage is a freedom to live and to move, a freedom to think and to feel, a freedom to act or to not act. Paul and Silas, freed from their chains, chose not to leave. And that points to a different kind of freedom than it's amazing to think about. It's a freedom that's three-dimensional, that's very much has roots in the physical reality, but also has freedom spiritually and emotionally and mentally. It's a captivity that is also physical and emotional and spiritual and mental. And it's truly amazing to think about the little girl's declaration, right? Or the declaration of the spirit that seems to be possessing her. There's a whole mystery when it comes to spiritual forces of evil. I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on it. I studied Old Testament Hebrew scripture. I can only read the text for what it says. There are real forces of spiritual evil, and it seems like the goodness of God is confronting one of them in this story. The little girl's voice says, "These are servants of the Most High God." These are, or in the NRSV it says, "These are slaves of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." Now wait a second. The way of salvation, the way of freedom, but she's calling them servants. Servants to the Most High God. There's a juxtaposition there. There's something that should catch us. Her statement talks about how they are servants, but they are proclaiming freedom and salvation. And it seems like maybe those things, most of the time, are at odds. You know, if we think about what they do in this story, there's a lot of risk. Because Paul and Silas, they don't just hunker down low. I mean, they are a ethnic minority in a place, you know, Christians, Jewish folks have already been driven out of Rome. Like, there's a lot of political realities going on in the back part of this story in Acts 16. But they don't just kind of like tuck their tail and put their head down and try to make it through. They risk. They risk. And yes, Paul is so annoyed that he finally is willing to risk, but he does risk. He risks disrupting economic systems that are exploitative. He risks proclaiming the way of salvation through prayer and song as they are incarcerated. They do not tuck their head down. Somehow they lift their eyes up and they look to Jesus, because in Jesus they have experienced freedom and a message of hope and a way of salvation. For some of us who are a bit more sensible and pragmatic, that's me, by the way. I'm the one who doesn't speed because I don't want to get pulled over. I'm a very practical person, and my dad was the same way. I don't think I ever saw my dad's speedometer go over the speed limit, ever. He's like, that's why they call it the limit, Seth. I don't know. I have to teach my kids how to drive someday. I'm terrified. You know, and it's not that I've never sped before. I got a ticket driving to the seminary when I was in seminary. Isn't that great? Talk about irony, right? No, I'm a very practical and pragmatic person, so I weigh the risks with the rewards. I'm constantly thinking, oh, wow, well, but if I do that, you know, I never make an uncalculated risk, if that makes sense. I never, like, lean with a ladder on this. My father-in-law, when he was cutting down the trees, like Isaiah said, he cut it down piece by piece because we live in the middle of town. And he's the kind of guy who has the chainsaw, and he's like pivoting with one foot, and he's leaning over, and he's cutting off the branches like this, right? He's an incredibly generous person who lives a little bit more risky than I do. I hate heights. Anyway, they did it while I was at school. I think that was a grace. No, but for those of us who are a bit more pragmatic, their actions seem downright risky. And it's shocking, but there's a freedom that they live in where the consequences of what might happen for them confronting evil, the consequences of what might happen as they sit incarcerated in prison, it seems like they're free. They're free of fear. They're free of what might happen. They live with this emboldened self. And I'm not telling us to be reckless. Please don't hear that. There was a time where recklessness was worshipped in the church. I'm not saying we need to be reckless. But Paul and Silas live with a freedom that just makes me go, wow. Goodness gracious. There's something about how the little girl was telling people the future, and Paul and Silas sit in a situation where I can imagine my stomach churning and my brain working out all the different scenarios of what might happen to me as I sit in chains in prison, and they don't have any concern for the future of what might happen because they have experienced freedom, real freedom. There's something about how it doesn't matter what the physical reality is. In their heart, in their soul, in their being, they are free. And if I had a different week this last week, we just had 2.5 weeks of COVID. Goodness gracious, that was not fun. It was awful. If I had a different week, I could have talked to some of my friends who work doing peacemaking work around the world, and I could have heard their stories of the way that they see hope in the midst of hopelessness. And here in the United States, I could talk to some of my friends who work in community building and in being the church embodied, and I could share some of the stories. I don't have those stories. I didn't have time this week. I'm sorry. But there's something about how the deep love of Jesus anchors them in the midst of this story that is stunning to me. There's a verse in Matthew 11 that says, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." One of the writers that I read this week says that the invitation is to all who are having a hard time in life, all who have had, life has been hard work, and everyone who feels overwhelmed. I remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus blesses the meek. The meek are those who are easily imposed upon. Is there anyone who's more easily imposed upon than small children? Jesus always redirects our eyes to the margin, to the people who are pushed out, who are ignored, to those who are easily imposed upon. And Jesus, in Matthew 11, doesn't extend to people who are tired a mattress or a vacation, although that would sound really good. He extends to them a work instrument for plowing, a yoke. The gift is to be able to carry life in a new way and grace for the work that is to be done. And I know that for some of us, all we have experienced in the last week feels like burden. Maybe it's been weeks before, months before, years before. The burdens that we carry that are physical burdens, as far as our health, as far as our reality, our physical reality. For some of us, it has nothing to do with physical reality. It's all here and here, and it's just as real. And for those of you who have carried burdens through the last week or the last month or the last year, I need you to hear those words of grace from Jesus. The words of grace saying, come to me. If you're tired and if life has chewed you up and spit you out over and over again, I want to give you rest. I want to give you grace upon grace upon grace. We don't have to guess whether or not God's heart is with those who are suffering. God's heart is already there. And maybe the other part of it, so, and there's lots of times in scripture where it says, where it talks about God extending grace to those who are hurting and oppressed and tired and vulnerable. Exodus 33, 14, my presence will go with you and I will give you rest. Psalm 23, he makes me lie down in green pastures and leads me beside still waters and restores my soul. In Ezekiel 34, I myself will be the shepherd of my sheep and I will help them to lay, I will make them lay down, says the Lord God. I will seek the lost and I will bring back the strayed and I will bind up the injured and I will strengthen the weak. I think for all of us, the yoke doesn't just imply rest, though, right? The yoke implies that there's work to be done. And I can't think of a week more poignantly where, again, it's so obvious that there are systems in our world and in our country that need to be broken down. They need to be changed. And the church has to bear witness to that. We need to stand together against violence. We need to stand together against the clinging on to of power. So, for all of us, God is calling, this is my last thing, I got like, it's like six statements or eight statements about God will, okay? And then I'm done. Thank you for hanging in there with me. For all of us, God is calling us to come and follow. God will walk with us in paths of justice and righteousness, into God's right ordering of things. God will walk with us, sending us to proclaim freedom for the prisoner and good news to the poor. God will walk with us as we pass through the valley of the shadow of death. God will walk with us as we confront violence and evil, as we confront systems and dismantle them, especially those that are oppressive. God will walk with us as we do the hard things like Paul and Silas, even if we are afraid to stand. God will walk with us as we learn to beat weapons into gardening tools, and God will walk with us as we tell others of the hope found in Jesus.